all loneliness, angers, hatreds, envies, and itchings that hell contains, if rolled into one single experience and put into the scale against the least moment of the joy that is felt by the least in heaven, would have no weight that could be registered at all. Well, hello everyone, and welcome back to Reading with Joy. We are on chapter 12, nearly to the end, of The Great Divorce by C.S. Lewis. And this week we're looking at a very important chapter. As these chapters kind of roll on, I feel like they begin to ascend in importance. They become even more and more evident kind of what the view and the message that Lewis is trying to get across is. And with this tragedian, we see more than almost anyone how the choice that he has presented is the choice of reality and joy versus illusion and misery. Now let me just pause here to acknowledge this chapter is full of many controversial and complicated ideas. And my aim with it is less to give you my own perspective on them, so I'm not exactly telling you my theological opinions, but more to kind of unpack what Lewis is saying. So go with that proviso that this doesn't necessarily reflect my views, but that I hope that it helps you understand what's happening in the chapter. So let's go ahead and dive into this week's discussion. There's kind of three things that we'll be looking at with this chapter, and I'll give you a little brief summary of what happens in it in a minute. But the three things are, first of all, that Lewis presents the idea that this kind of idea of hell or of isolation is necessary in some sense because both because God respects our choices, even to reject him, but also because, as he says, the joy of heaven will not always be subject to the misery of hell. If people choose to live in their own self-misery, they needn't be tyrants over the joy of heaven. But secondly, that it's also just a logical necessity because he's presented this idea that turning towards joy and towards God is towards reality. To turn away is to turn away from reality. And so he says that this really is a real choice, to turn away from God, to turn away from reality, is truly to turn towards something darker and smaller. And that is a real choice. And so that's kind of he kind of makes that point. But then finally, that the action of God's pity, though he says not the passion, is always available to every soul. And that's kind of mysterious in the sense of time and how that works itself out. So let's go ahead and kind of first do a bit of a talk through what happens this scene. So it opens with him saying, basically, I've almost never seen anything like the struggle of the dwarf ghost against joy. And it comes this kind of climactic scene where he's already had this conversation with his wife, Sarah Smith, and she is just saying, come into heaven. But slowly but surely in this scene, as she's really appealing to him, the dwarf, who represents the true kind of depiction of the man's soul, becomes smaller and smaller as the tragedian, who's kind of the depiction of this illusion that he presents of himself, kind of the play actor that he gets to stir up people's pity and their respect, becomes bigger and bigger. And finally, at the end, in this really kind of horrifying image, the tragedian, so the illusion, the projection of this man, swallows the chain and swallows the real man, so that there's not a real man left anymore, but only the projection of what he wants people to think of him. And it's this really kind of startling scene, and then all of a sudden he disappears, and Sarah Smith kind of goes on, and she goes on rejoicing, and this really troubles the narrator. He says, can it be good that Sarah Smith can go on and basically live her happy life in heaven and not be bothered by the misery of the tragedy, and can she truly just let him go? And does the one soul that escapes to hell spoil all of the joy of the souls in heaven? And that's kind of the question that's set up at the end of the today. And then you have this whole long kind of monologue where Lewis really sets out his ideas through George MacDonald. And then we'll get into the ideas that George MacDonald deals with today. So that's kind of an overview of what happens in the chapter. So let's start by beginning with this first point that I wanted to make out, which is this is a difficult chapter, but I think that what the chapter does is it both creates a sense of the need for judgment or finality, but it also opens up the possibility of eternal salvation for everyone. So it's kind of this interesting tension. But one of the main points he makes, and MacDonald is kind of the one who makes this for him, is that this idea of hell, or at least of a place where people go to kind of look at themselves and to be turned inward and to not enjoy reality, is a necessity because hell will not be allowed to hold heaven hostage. And this is really demonstrated in the quote where she says, the demand of the loveless and the self-imprisoned that they should be allowed to blackmail the universe, that till they consent to be happy on their own terms, no one else shall taste joy. That there should be the final power, that hell should be able to veto heaven. Actually, I think that's MacDonald. And ultimately, the answer to this chapter is that hell will not be allowed to veto heaven. And I think this is kind of a matter of, I almost think of it like boundaries. I realized there was a time in my life when I really struggled with the idea of judgment, that God could, that seems scary and terrible and difficult. And I think there's a certain level to which we should be scared of judgment. We should live righteous lives. But I also came to a point where I realized that I could trust, first of all, there were two things. First, I could trust a God who would become human. That's pretty wild. That's a pretty intense and crazy thing. And that kind of comes later on in the chapter. A God could become human is not going to willy-nilly judge people without mercy. And so I could trust his judgments because he is loving and because he is good. But second of all, I think the more that I've seen in my life injustice towards victims, no matter how that looks, whether it's in an intense way or people who are throughout their lives kind of just put under the thumb of someone else, you begin to see that to not want judgment, to not want the idea that someone will experience the repercussions of their choice if that is to turn away from God, is actually not to be on the side of the victim. And I think that's what's kind of powerfully portrayed with Sarah Smith, which is that she is so willing for her husband, who seems to have kind of emotionally blackmailed her whole life, to be redeemed, to enjoy joy. But the goodness of heaven and the justice of heaven is that he won't be allowed to do that if it's at the cost of her joy, if it's at the cost of her enjoying and loving God. And I think that this idea of recognizing that true justice does mean that everyone can repent, but that they do have to repent, is actually, it's favoring the victim. It's favoring those who have experienced deep trials. And it's something I actually came to think about more oddly when I was RA. I was a resident assistant at my undergrad, and I had 56 girls on my floor, and it was at a liberal arts Christian school. And I saw so many, you know, girls would come to me and talk to me at their problems, because, you know, an RA kind of enforces rules, but is also there for emotional support and planning things. And there were so many times I would have girls sit with me and say, they would describe these issues, whether it was with guys or with people who'd been mean to them, and they would say, oh, I just don't want to be mean. And they would stay in these terrible situations, not because they felt that it was the right thing to do or because it really was the right thing to do, but because they were afraid of appearing mean. And what I began to be able to say to them, because I began to recognize this, was living justly and having boundaries is not being mean. It is simply not allowing evil to enter your territory. So I think that's kind of what's being depicted with this. So if you've asked someone repeatedly not to scream at you, and they continue to scream at you, and you say, well, I don't hate you, but you're not allowed in the realm of my life, that is not hateful. That is not judgmental. It is saying, I'm not going to allow this darkness into my world. And I think that ultimately that's what's being depicted in this scene. It's kind of a cosmic version of that. And I think it's actually a very good way to think about judgment, which is that everyone should belong. Everyone is welcomed. Everyone is invited. To the very moment that the ghost is about to disappear, Sarah Smith is speaking to him, asking him to drop the chain or to move further in. But it is not hateful. It is not unloving to say, if someone cannot repent of evil, if someone cannot repent of emotionally blackmailing people, if someone cannot turn away from that, then there it's not unloving to say, then you can't be allowed in this space. The people who are allowed in this space are those who love, those who forgive, those who are not self-righteous. So I think on one level, you know, if you want to call that boundaries, this is just depicting a spiritual boundaries. It's saying that, as MacDonald says, that hell should not be able to veto heaven. And in the end, this is a space where, yes, everyone is invited, but you have to lay down the weapons of making other people feel pity for you, and of emotionally blackmailing and being unkind and mean. And I think reckoning with that is actually a really important thing for us. And it's an important thing to recognize that judgment, and I talked about this in a podcast in the spring, judgment is not just something we should fear because it's judgment's not the same as punishment. Judgment is saying this is what is right and what is wrong, and this is what will be allowed in the confines of heaven. And so in a way, I think it's actually a really beautiful picture of justice being done for Sarah Smith, because she spent her whole life under his thumb, And she loves him. She gives him forgiveness. She offers everything. But at the end of the day, his blackmail and his kind of emotional abuse will not be allowed to maintain, be there in heaven, unless he repents of it and turns away from it. So I think that's one thing we see in this, is the idea that hell will not be allowed to hold heaven hostage. That ultimately, if you cannot let go of this sin, you cannot be allowed to be there. And that everyone will help you let go of it. Everyone will guide you through it, but you have to be willing to submit to the joy, to the beauty, and to the reality. And I think that has a lot of implications for our ordinary life. And I want to encourage you that if you have some, we all need to be humble. So we need to remember that we're never perfect. But if you have someone in your life who is routinely emotionally blackmailing you or being unkind or lying, it is not unloving to have a boundary between you and them. That just means not allowing that behavior in your life. And that can actually be very loving, because sometimes it can be the thing that allows people to recognize the issue in themselves and move towards either health with you or towards redemption in heaven. So that's my little kind of aside, my little footnote, my something I'm really passionate about, especially after having lived with a whole bunch of wonderful, kind girls who are sometimes afraid to put up appropriate, kind, and loving boundaries because they didn't want to appear mean. So that's one thing we see in this. It's the idea that hell will not be allowed to hold heaven hostage. And I love, I was saying this is kind of a picture of Sarah Smith experiencing some kind of justice. And there's this wonderful part where once the ghost has disappeared, it has this beautiful little kind of almost poem where it says, "The happy Trinity is her home. Nothing can trouble her joy. She is the bird that evades every net, the wild deer that leaps every pitfall. Like the mother bird to its chickens or a shield the armed knight, so is the Lord to her mind, his unchanging lucidity. Bogies will not scare her in the dark, bullets will not frighten her by day. Falsehood tricked out as truth assail her in vain." Also, I think her husband is a falsehood tricked out as truth. "She sees through the lies as if it were glass. The invisible germ will not harm her, nor the glittering sunstroke. 1,000 fail to solve the problem, 10,000 choose the wrong turning, but she passes safely through. He details immortal gods to her, upon every road where she must travel. They take her hand at hard places. She will not stub her toe in the dark. She may walk among lions and rattlesnakes, among the dinosaurs and nurseries of lionettes. He fills her to brim with the immensity of life. He leads her to see the world's desire." This is such a beautiful image. Again, Lewis is so good at depicting the image of things redeemed. And to me, I think this is an image of her life redeemed. Her love that had sometimes allowed her to be trampled on is no longer trampled on, and she was truly safe because she was kept in the palm of love's true hand. And what's also fun about this is I was thinking, this sounds really familiar, and I realized that it's totally kind of a rewriting and a reimagining of, I think it's Psalm 61, or is it Psalm 61 I was reading this morning? I have it in the show notes. Go look it up in the show notes. But "those who live in the shelter of the Most High will find rest in the shadow of the Almighty." Sorry, I'm tired. And it goes through and it describes, you know, all these things that they'll escape. And so you can kind of look at the parallels, like when it says, "He'll rescue you from every trap and protect you from the deadly diseases." And you can look at that in hers where it says, "The invisible germ will not harm her, nor the glittering sunstroke. And the 10,000 fall at your right hand," and all that. So go look that up and see. It's kind of a fun comparison to look at how he imaged that. But I think that's really this beautiful image of her loving and giving and forgiving, but that ultimately her love and forgiveness will not be trampled upon because God will protect her and will not allow this hell to be the tyranny of heaven. But the second thing, and this is almost more fundamental to Lewis's philosophy, is that that it's just impossible for him to stay in heaven because he has turned away from reality. And again, we have this throughout the whole book, which is that the problem with the souls in hell is they're turned inward. And that as they're turned inward, they're no longer getting their being from God. They're no longer turned outwards towards the God who makes the source of all things. They're turned inward. And even as they love not real people, but the projections of the people and the ways they make them feel. And in the Tragedian, this is really well depicted, that he has substituted who he truly is for this kind of performance of who he is. And so as he does that, it's not an issue really even of punishment. It's an issue of, if he cannot accept reality, his own being will diminish and diminish to the point where you almost can't see it. And that's where Lewis has been, I don't know if you'd say accused or called or observed to be something of an annihilationist, which is the idea that souls that turn away from God are not eternally punished, but that they just disappear, because to turn away from God is to turn away from the source of your being. And Lewis kind of depicts that here. And that's where we get this idea that hell is nowhere and heaven is everywhere. So if he's going to exist in everywhere, he must turn towards reality. And that hell is nothing and that heaven is everything. And that's in the, and that's really well depicted in the opening passage that I read to you, where it talks about how the moments of joy so much outweigh the moments of evil or of sin that you can't even weigh it against it, because ultimately evil or sin or the self-choice is a choice to move away from reality. So it's small and almost non-existent in comparison. And this also comes to kind of describe how Lewis describes the soul that's turned in on itself. So MacDonald says, "For a damned soul is nearly nothing. It is shrunk, shut up in itself. Good beats upon the damned incessantly as sound waves beat on the ears of the deaf, but they cannot receive it. Their fists are clenched, their teeth are clenched, their eyes are fast shut. First they will not, in the end they cannot, open their hands for gifts, their mouths for food, or their eyes to see." So we have this really kind of difficult picture of souls that have so turned away from God and turned away from even from others, from beauty, that they have become shut up in themselves, and they get smaller and smaller and smaller because there's nothing for their souls to attach themselves to. And again, I think that has really interesting psychological implications, because when you look at the development of self, even psychologically as children, we develop as children based on how we relate to others, and we get our identity based on how we relate to others and the world around us. So if you're only relating based on yourself, you become smaller and smaller and less existent. And this reminds me of the passage in Jeremiah 5:21. "Now hear this, O foolish and senseless people, who have eyes but do not see, who have ears but do not hear." That's kind of the tragedy that we see with this tragedian, is that he has eyes but he doesn't see, has ears but he doesn't hear, because he's being pleaded with to become real. And but that, I think, is ultimately also the picture of this, is that it's not so much a punishment of the souls in hell, but that for them to be real, to be recognizable, to be in heaven at all, they have to turn towards reality, because as they turn towards themselves, they become more and more shut up in the self, and the self has its identity in God. So the self even begins to disappear as it turns away from God. And also a fun thing to note is, I think that he's making a reference to, so MacDonald is the one who has this quote, right, where he says the damned is nearly nothing. And he has this thing where he says the fists are clenched, and the teeth are clenched, the eyes are fast shut. And I think this is an image of Lilith Lilith, the character in Lilith by George MacDonald. And to me, that whole book, if you read it, it's actually one of my favorites of George MacDonald's. It's very strange, but it's basically asking the question of, can God redeem anyone? And to look at that question, he picks Lilith, who's this character from Jewish folklore, who's the second wife of Adam, and she's this kind of demon wife who eats babies, and she's terrible. So it's basically like he picked the worst character possible to say, can God redeem even her? And there's this really significant scene where she has her fist clenched, and where to be redeemed, she has to either open up her hand or have it cut off. And it's really quite visceral, but it's also quite compelling. Go read Lilith. It is amazing. But I think that's kind of the picture that he's trying to appeal to. So this is what we see in the second part, is that that the souls are judged or sent to back to the old town or to hell because simply they can do no other. If they turn away from reality, they will turn to unreality, and they will become smaller and smaller. But we want to end on a note of hope. And that is that all the souls, according to Lewis, are always offered with this choice to turn towards goodness. And he uses this with the idea that he says that the passion of pity will not always exist. So Sarah Smith will not always have to be subject to the misery of her husband. But the action of pity does. And the action of pity is that the greatest of all went into the smallest of places. He descended to death. So we see this idea of Christ being the greatest, who descends into the tiny crack where none of the spirits can fit, to offer them the chance to come back with him. He says, "It was not long ago that he did descend. Time does not work that way once you've left earth. All moments have been or shall be, shall were, or are present in the moment of his descending. There is no spirit imprisoned to whom he did not preach. So basically what he's showing is this idea that Christ is always presenting the option to turn towards reality and towards joy to the souls in the old town. And he kind of leaves this ambiguous with the idea of time. It's kind of like what we're seeing are not really narratives. We're seeing kind of choices that have been present to these people throughout all time. So then the question becomes, is there really a change? Or is this kind of depicting, well, they always would have made this choice, and so for eternity they always will have that choice. But he kind of leaves that open to us. We're not sure. Also, this is not a totally crazy or off-scale idea. He's getting it from the Bible. This question where he says, there is no spirit in prison to whom he did not preach. It's from 1 Peter 3:19, where it says, for Christ also suffered sins once and for all, the righteous for the unrighteous, to bring you to God. He was put to death in the body, but made alive in the spirit, in which he also went and preached to the spirits in prison. And that's been interpreted to mean that that Christ went and preached to the spirits in hell and offered them the chance to come back. And that has a lot of history in Christian tradition. There's the idea of the harrowing of hell, that Jesus went after his death and before his resurrection and harrowed hell. He brought out everyone he wanted to, who would respond to his sacrifice, back to heaven. And that's particularly apparent in the Greek Orthodox tradition. So MacDonald, Lewis's great literary mentor, did hold that in the end, every person would give in to that severe mercy. There's a sense that how in the end could not every single person eventually respond to the descending of Christ? And Lewis kind of leaves this option open. He's a bit vague about time. And so we kind of have this question of, will souls ultimately and eternally reject God? Or is there perhaps always this hope? So there's kind of this mix of harshness in that if you choose to reject reality, to reject God, to reject, to say, I would rather keep my vices than learn to truly love my neighbor, then God will respond and respect that choice. But there's also this hope that that choice is maybe not once and for all, that maybe, just maybe, or maybe not, it's hard to tell with how Lewis depicts this, that choice for redemption is always offered to you. And I think Lewis held that in the end, some people would ultimately reject, even with all knowledge, even if they were perfectly knowledgeable about all the options in front of them, they would rather choose themselves than God. But MacDonald kind of had this hope that every soul in the end would eventually release their love of self and be open to God. And so I thought I would let you know, I was informed by one of our listeners and one of our book clubbers, David Jack, I think that's his name on Facebook, is a, actually translates many of MacDonald's works, and he said that if you wanted to, you get into a lot more of MacDonald's actual ideas on choice and will and salvation and whether or not that would be universalist or whatever on MacDonald's thoughts, and you can find out more about that by looking at several of his translations. There's the Castle Warlock. And when I say translations, it's because a good deal of the text in several of MacDonald's works are in kind of Scots. So it's the Scots language that you could kind of almost sometimes pick out English, but it's hard to difficult to understand. So he's translated this for people so they can read some of MacDonald's work more easily. And he's got Robert Falconer and Castle Warlock, and I believe there's a new one coming out soon. And I've attached in my show notes some of the passages that these passages from Lewis seem to be mimicking and kind of dealing with, and the idea of the severe mercy that ultimately that MacDonald thought ultimately everyone would have to bend to the mercy of God, and that was something that he hoped that he would see. And so go to that and find out those passages and check out David's work. I always love supporting people who are doing important things like that. So that's this week. We have looked at the idea that out of love, Sarah Smith would not go. And we've looked this week at three different ideas. First of all, that the old town existed partially as a provision so that hell would never veto heaven, that Sarah Smith would no longer be at the mercy of her husband's vindictive pity mongering. And then secondly, that also this exists because Lewis is trying to depict that truly to turn away from God is to turn away from reality, and to turn away from reality is to become diminished to the point where you almost don't exist anymore. But that finally, or perhaps you don't exist anymore, but that finally, that Christ is the one who descends into this almost non-existence, descends into hell, and is constantly, it appears, offering the opportunity for souls to respond, to turn towards reality, and to become real. It reminds me of, sorry, my mom just texted me. It reminds me of Pinocchio. That's a rather silly example, but it's the idea of going from an illusion, from a wooden boy, to the real person. And that is an option always offered to us, at least in Lewis's depiction. So I'm sure this has stirred up many thoughts. So I would love to hear your thoughts in the chapter, what you thought was interesting, what was compelling, what bothered you. So go let me know what you think and chime in your thoughts at the Facebook group or on the Twitter Reading with Joy. And I look forward to hearing what you think. Much love to you all, and I hope you have a lovely week.